Well, hey guys, welcome to Down to the Wire. Appreciate you guys joining for this special episode. We have a guest with us, Matt Brown. Matt, how's it going, man?
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I'm doing well.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining and taking time out of your day for this. So, yeah, I guess we'll just go ahead and get started. Matt, why don't you go ahead and tell us and our listeners a little bit about you, what you do, and kind of the main thing that you kind of deal with when it comes to sports and in writing and everything.
Sure. So I run the Extra Points newsletter. I've been doing that full time since April of 2020. Extra Points covers the off-the-field stories that shape college athletics. So it's a rare sports publication that really doesn't write about who wins games. I don't break down tape. I don't give gambling advice. I don't really follow recruiting. And it's not that because I don't care about those things, but because everyone else on the internet does those things. And so yeah. I have focused my reporting energy and my analytic energy and what I write about to write about things like NIL. To write about lawsuits and legal developments happening in college athletics, about conference realignment, media rights valuations, licensing opportunities, how people get and spend money, that sort of work. I worked at Vox Media for 6.5 years before that launched. I've been a working sports writer for over a decade now then. But I came into this industry through the back door. I don't have a journalism degree. I used to teach elementary school. I did political organizing. I did a bunch of other stuff before this. And I think that multidisciplinary background made it easier actually for me to kind of transition into writing, and especially being a sports writer that writes about all the other stuff that's connected to sports, which I think is easier because I've spent a lot of my life doing things that are not just sports. So that's what's built this publication. It's read by, it's got over 18,000 subscribers now, and is read by a lot of administrators and industry leaders. So it's something that I love that fans read it, and I'm glad to write for them. But it's also a daily part of the reading for most conference commissioners, lots of athletic directors, and people that work in the college sports industry.
Yeah, man. So I guess business should be booming right now with you, with all this news and everything that's going on with college sports and all the lawsuits and the NCAA. And, you know, we'll probably dive into a lot of those questions that we have for you, and love to get your insight on that. I guess kind of the first thing that question that I'll ask you is really, I guess, a little bit more on the field type thing. Our last podcast that we had was just an immediate reaction. Nick Saban retires. So go ahead and why don't you go ahead and give us some thoughts on, you know, Nick Saban retires, and then maybe a little bit of thoughts on, hey, Kalen DeBoer, new guy. Mason over here is a big Alabama fan, as I'm sure you can see in my flag in the background. I am not. So we have a good fun back and forth. But yeah, what do you think on Nick Saban retiring, and then, you know, Kalen DeBoer obviously filling some big shoes over in Tuscaloosa?
Yeah, I mean, you can't really overstate what a big deal this is, because Nick Saban is, by every objective measure, as much as I'm sure it might pain you to hear this, like, he was the greatest college football coach of all time. You know, even adjusted for what people did in like 1905 and 1908. And obviously Bear Bryant had a great career, but Saban's the best to ever do it. And what I think his real genius was, wasn't just in schematics. He was an exceptional chalkboard guy. Nick Saban, his ability to come up with and teach defensive schemes, particularly obviously within the secondary, like that vocabulary, that language, and those concepts have permeated throughout not just all of college football, but college football period, right? There are high schoolers and middle schoolers that are trying to teach some of the concepts that Saban brought into the world, which is not something that elite coaches are always known for. But what I think Saban was really gifted at was organizational genius. Like Alabama, you know, I'm a little bit older, I think, than you guys, and maybe some of your listeners here, but Alabama used to suck. Like, you know, this is a team that's obviously still one of the most celebrated and successful programs in all of college football, but they're not recession proof. Like this, you know, and when I was a kid in the 90s, Alabama would get their ass kicked by Northern Illinois. Like they weren't anything. And part of that is because Alabama has a really difficult booster culture. There's a lot of rich people that want to be heavily involved, and they're all going in different directions, and they will turn on your ass quick. And we've seen throughout Alabama history of several guys between Bear and Saban that won 9-10 games that were competing for Sugar Bowls and quit. because they couldn't handle everything else that came with that job. And Nick was better at that than anybody ever, which I think speaks to how difficult this, you know, DeBoer's job is as he's coming in there. Like, he's a very good football coach. He's done nothing but win everywhere that he's been. He's won all over the country at all kinds of different levels. And he's brought in a very experienced staff. But there's going to be a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with football that makes that job very difficult. And obviously him coming in the NIL transfer portal era makes that even harder because, as I'm sure you're both aware, Alabama under Nick Saban was not paying top dollar for talent. They absolutely were not paying top dollar for high schoolers, and they generally weren't paying top dollar to retain players. And the reason for that, one, Alabama is corporate community and it's big, big, big money people. That is not Alabama's a poor state. This is not a place that has money like Texas has money or Ohio State even has money. But also because Saban correctly would tell people, you're going to come here because if you play for me for 4 years, you're going to win a national title and you're going to go to the NFL. And the NFL second contract is where you make transformational money. So you're going to take a pay cut to come play for me to make more money. And Kirby Smart at Georgia is doing the exact same thing right now. But when the king leaves and suddenly you bring in a guy that can't make that promise because he hasn't done it yet, everybody wants the top dollar. And Alabama did not have the infrastructure, the resources to offer that immediately. And that's why you saw a run on that roster. So I'm not saying that DeBoer can't do this, but being the guy that follows the guy historically is always a very, very difficult job. And given what kind of place Alabama is and when it's happening, it's that much harder.
Yeah, so I really like what you said about his organizational skills, because right before him with Mike Shula, it was like the boosters were basically trying to run the program. And so There wasn't a much like give and take in that. But when Saban came in, he like put his foot down and was like, no, if y'all want this to roll how I want it to roll, then y'all are going to jump on the same page as me and I'm going to get it going. And I mean, he was able to completely change everything. So I do agree with you in the sense that when it comes to Kalen DeBoer, he's got to be able to continue to get his foot down and be able to get the type of money in that a lot of other programs are getting in, like Ohio State. I mean, you saw they had an insane transfer portal class. But with DeBoer, the biggest problem he's going to face so far this year is how difficult of a job it's going to be to kind of get back some of the depth that he lost. Because, I mean, Alabama lost like, I don't even know the exact number, but it was like 30-something guys in the portal. So, like, you're losing a lot of depth. So being able to kind of come back and get that is going to be interesting. And, I mean, just from a fan perspective, it's going to be interesting just seeing, like, the differences in the two coaches. Like you said, Nick Saban was so keen on the defensive end, and he basically had the defense rolling every single year. And it's like almost opposite of the spectrum for DeBoer. He's a super great offensive mind. And so seeing how maybe what the difference is going to be between the two, if DeBoer is able to kind of keep the defense rolling also while also bringing his offense along with him. So I'm excited for DeBoer.
It definitely won't be boring, right? I think the other thing that I'll say about all this that is interesting about DeBoer is that he's never really been in a place where he's had truly elite talent. I mean, he recruited well, and Washington is going to send a lot of guys to the NFL this year, but they were also an extremely old team. They had a ton of fifth and sixth year guys, and they managed to find a transcendent quarterback out of the scratch and dent heap through the transfer portal. And when he was successful at Fresno, when he's been successful other places, it's been finding guys that were overlooked and developing them exceptionally well. And Alabama hasn't really had to do that since like the early 80s. And that's not a way that they're used to winning. Saban was still very good at this. You know, Alabama took three-star guys. Many of them became very good. But it will be interesting to see how this roster and this culture change from always having the best dudes, or almost always having the best dudes, to still having a damn good roster, but maybe winning in a different way. And then will people respect that? Like the joke that I've kind of shared with some of my media colleagues is, Kalen DeBoer sounds like a guy who's going to go like 50-7 and get fired. and that's probably unavoidable, right? We'll see how he does in the playoff.
Hey, I mean, as an LSU fan, I'm fine with that. Just keep having the turnover at the head coach job, and it's fine with me.
Sure. Anytime. There's one place that's always the paragon of stability and even-handedness. It's LSU.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Sure. So kind of bouncing off of, obviously, Nick Saban retiring, you know, you look just kind of college sports in general, kind of as a whole. It seems like a lot of the legends of the sport really recently have been retiring. I mean, you just had Nick Saban, you had Coach K, Roy Williams in basketball. And there's even more coaches that are, you know, younger coaches now that are maybe looking to jump ship. I mean, you just had the Boston College head coach leave to take a defensive coordinator job in the NFL. And, you know, there's been talks of, hey, and I don't know if as much it's talks along with, hey, everybody knows Chip Kelly doesn't want to be at UCLA. He wants to leave or he's going to get let go, you know?
Yeah.
So it seems like there's a lot, you know, obviously going on with coaches wanting to leave the college game. What would you kind of attribute that too when it comes to Nick and some of these older guys and even some of these young guys that just seem to be jumping for maybe some of the pro level jobs?
I honestly don't think it's that big of a trend. And I understand why people are saying that. Like, Nick Saban was over 70 years old. People, you know, 70-year-old, they don't maintain that level of execution as business executives. The only place where people at that age tend to stick around forever is like in politics and in the clergy. Like that's we don't see that in the NBA really either or anywhere else. It's unusual. It's no secret that the game has changed and it's become more difficult and complicated for a lot of coaches. It's a new generation of athletes who require a different way to be coached, and it's easier if you're multiple generations removed to have a harder time relating to them. Unquestionably, the current iteration of NIL and the transfer portal has added a level of instability and extra work that not everybody gravitates to. And it's not a state secret right now that for many jobs, the NFL does give you a better quality of life. What's wild is that college tends to pay more. It's not as true for head coaches outside of a couple of examples, but if you're going to make more money as a coordinator at Ohio State or Alabama than you're going to be as the defensive coordinator as the Chicago Bears. If you're a strength coach, if you're a position coach, you will make more money in the Big Ten or the SEC than you will in the NFL, which is wild to think about. You know, if you're director of player personnel, will make way more money in college right now than the equivalent would in the NFL. What you're seeing, a handful of guys who've been doing this for a long time, deciding to get out. That happens all the time. And you have a couple of coaches who come from an NFL background that want to go back. Yeah, it's unusual to see a sitting head coach this late in the year at Boston College go back to the NFL. But Jeff Hafley coached in the NFL a hell of a lot longer than he coached in college. He was at Boston College for a couple of years. He was Ohio State's defensive backs coach and defensive coordinator for 2 years. And he was like a GA at Rutgers for a minute. But most of his career was in the NFL. It's not a shock to see Jim Harbaugh, the guy that went to the Super Bowl and has interviewed with NFL teams for 4 consecutive years, to eventually leave, especially when the NCAA is coming or after you've already won a championship and you don't really have anything else to accomplish. So yeah, if you're a coach, whether you're a head coach or a position coach or an assistant coach who spent the bulk of your life in the NFL and you recognize that, hey, having a union is not so bad. Having predictability in labor relations and a structure and not having to recruit isn't so bad. I would imagine that you will look to go back to that world where you can have a little bit more time off. But we also just saw, like, you know, right before we hopped on this show, Michigan just hired a sitting defense, you know, has hired an NFL defensive coordinator to come back. Like, we don't have to worry about a brain drain because there's only so many NFL jobs. And most of the people that are complaining the most to reporters right now about how they don't want to be in college sports, they're not good enough to be in the NFL anyway. And so they're just going to have to grin and bear it. If you want to quit, you can go ahead and quit. There's a whole bunch of people at the football coaching convention that would love to have that job.
Yeah, so with the calendar being so messed up right now with college football, whether you want to say it's because of transfer portal or because there's about 100 different signing days right now, like, are there any certain ways that you can think that would fix the problem when it comes to the coaches basically having to work 20 or 24/7 right now?
There's a super easy solution, and it's one that will eventually happen, and coaches want it. And university presidents and athletic directors don't. That's make them employees, man. It's literally the only legal way you can get around doing it. Because what we have in the NFL and the NBA and everything else is we have what's called a collective bargaining agreement, which provides structure and order to roster transition rules. You can't just get up and leave the NFL whenever you want because you got a contract. And then the CBA says free agency is open from this date to this date, and here's when you're allowed to talk to teams, and here's when you're not, and here's when you're contractually stuck to this team because you signed it. And you can sign those contracts because you're an employee. If you're not an employee, which is what college athletic leaders have gone to court several times and saying these are student athletes, we should treat them as students, then you legally can't enforce any of these rules because you can transfer whenever the hell you want. And that's what's happening right now. Because the NCAA, and when I say that, I'm talking about, you know, the Big Ten, the SEC, ADs of these places, they would love to have a stricter transfer window. They would love to have year-to-year contracts that limit when people can leave. They would love to have, if not a salary cap, more publicly disclosable NIL salaries. So agents who are fake agents can't lie about who's offering $7,000 a year or a month and getting everybody confused. But if you put those rules in place, you're in court in 2 days for antitrust violations. That's exactly what's happening with Tennessee and Virginia and the NCAA right now over the NIL violations with NECA. So until you do that, until we move towards an employment model, which we are, college can kick and scream, but the courts are going to make them do it. There's no way to fix any of this because there any structure that the NCAA tries to create themselves will lose in court.
Yeah, so okay. The thing that's been kind of throwing me for a loop with that is how, I guess, contracts would actually work and look in a sense because, you know, right now in college football, it's like, You can go to the draft after 3 years, but you also do have the fourth year option. You also do have a grad transfer option after that.
Yeah.
So it's like, do they just strict it and say, hey, you're going to be here for 4 years for X amount of dollars? Or do they kind of flirt with the MBA contracts where it's your contract is 3 years and you have a fourth year player option or a fourth year team option or something like that?
The truth is it's whatever is negotiated. I don't say that to be glib or anything, but you know, the 3 year, 4 year options and everything, that's a product of the players union, the NFL and the NBA haggling out something with management and they sit down there and they listen to their union members about what works for them. And you have to argue about it because not everyone's going to be on the same page. You have their lawyers and whatever the two sides can agree upon is the rule of the deal. I can certainly imagine a world where we have contracts where the bulk of those deals will be one-year deals because freshmen are 18 and 19 years old. Sometimes they're not even done physically developing yet. They're flaky. They fail academically. They fail personally. Schools are not going to be tripping over themselves to nail themselves to four-year long deals for freshmen because even five-star guys will fail 40% of the time. And that will be kind of maybe a wrinkle, right? Maybe Ball State will guarantee you for 3 years, and LSU won't. And maybe you have to wait. Do you want to bet on myself? Do I want to go for the more security? That's entirely possible. But not just the specifics of the contracts, but quite frankly, who the employer is still up for debate. And that's going to depend on who ends up representing the athletes and what that negotiation looks like. Because, you know, not to get political, right? But like if the school themselves is the employer, we got a lot of states in the South that are right to work states, or some of them even explicitly prohibit public sector unionizations, right? You can't be in a union and be an employee of Clemson because the state law doesn't allow it. So then are you an employee of the ACC? Are you an employee of Clemson Tigers LLC, you know, shell company? Do you change labor law throughout the country? Like there's some very complicated financial and political questions that have to be answered through all of this. And it's going to be ultimately in the hands of the courts. Like that's why so many big time programs are begging Congress to get involved because that's who fundamentally is in charge here, as frustrating as that might be.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely a frustrating kind of spot to be in to hope and pray and really, I guess, have your bottom line as a student athlete to hopefully be able to become employee to get benefits, you know, all that kind of stuff that looks at as well as a chart coach, hopefully to one day get a life and get a break in the schedule is to wait on Congress, which obviously changes out every 2 years when it comes to the House and the Senate on Senate seats, on who gets in, who actually has control, and obviously the different political ideologies of both the parties. So it makes things very, very slow.
It does.
And you also have people that are in Congress that couldn't tell you anything about what the actual issue is. I mean, I'm sure with some of the hearings that have been going on, there are people asking questions that have literally nothing to do with the topic that's at hand, just for political points, whether it's Democrat or Republican. I mean, you know, we would all kind of be on the same page with that. So, yeah, government is obviously problematic in these kind of ways on trying to get something moved quickly?
It's not a partisan issue so much here. I can tell you this as somebody who for work has had to watch a lot of state congressional hearings about NIL and watching a lot of these federal hearings. These are not sports fans. These are not people that follow how this industry works. They don't really know what's going on. And most of them don't care. And this is even with the U.S. Senate has a former football coach in it, and he's not well informed about how this works. There's a reason that Tubbs is not like the intellectual thought leader of these issues in Congress, because people think he's dumb. There are very unserious Democratic lawmakers involved with this here too. Like that's the frustration. And regardless of where you sit politically, that's why this is really going to be settled by judges, I think, because there's not going to be enough consensus among lawmakers to take this seriously. And maybe that's for the best, because we have Ukraine, we have border, we have crime, we have inflation. There's other things I think I would like them to focus on as much as I care about college football myself.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess with that, you know, people seems to be on their toes, just hoping that something new comes out. Like everybody, you know, in this day and age is super impatient and wants to get answers now and all that. What would you think is a realistic timeline on something big really happening? I mean, I think a lot of that probably depends on House versus NCAA. Obviously, you know, you just came out with a newsletter on your thoughts on the Big Ten and SEC alliance that I think is pretty hilarious, considering the alliance that the Big Ten had against the SEC however many years ago and how laughable that was. So give us thoughts on timeline that maybe is realistic to maybe consider, you know, a couple of years out. Obviously, you probably wouldn't expect anything to come out this summer, as some people would probably hope. But give us some thoughts as Big Ten.
I'll get out of here on this because I actually just have an important source call here.
Sure.
So I'll answer it here and say, friends, it's less than 2 years. The Johnson v. NCAA federal court case that's centered on the employment status of FCS football players. There'll be an initial decision about that this year, most likely. I'm sure that will be appealed, but you'll see like the first run of that pretty soon. House v. NCAA is scheduled to go to trial in January of next year. I would be shocked if that's not settled sometime this fall, which will be hundreds of millions of dollars exchanged here on both sides. And the NLRB ruling over USC is also going to come out this year. There'll be appeals. But honestly, before the end of this year, you're going to see so much legal and administrative push towards the employment status of athletes that there's going to be some pretty significant changes. It's not a far off intellectual abstraction. It's coming right away.
Great. That sounds great, Matt. We'll probably try and get you back on here maybe in a couple months just to see if there's any updates that happen. But why don't you go ahead and tell everybody where they can find you and connect with your work.
You bet. Friends, I appreciate you having me on here. You can find my coverage of the off-the-field stuff that shapes college athletics, including coverage of EA Sports College Football 25, which is
where there's a game coming out, right?
Allegedly, yeah. Right? A lot of that coverage, you can find that there. That's at extrapointsmb.com. Or you can find me on Twitter at Matt Brown.
Thanks, Matt. Have a good one.
Thanks, Matt.
So, Mason, thoughts on some of the information that Matt was able to get provide us?
Man, that was exciting, dude. Matt's obviously a very smart guy. He is very locked in, like he was saying, with all the off-field stuff. So that was actually, to me, that was very exciting to hear from him. And kind of his thoughts on NIL and the calendar and everything like that. But man, that was a blast.
It was a blast. And we're going to try and have some more interviews, whether it's with Matt Brown or a couple other people. So be on the lookout for that during the off season. And that's going to end it for us. Pretty short for our own standards, Mason. So, but yeah, thank you guys so much for checking in. And we will catch you guys on the next episode.